You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, recording from Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, on today's episode, I'm not joined by my regular co-host, Katie, but in her stead, I'm very happy to have back on the show the Diplomats Editor-in-Chief and resident China expert, Shannon Tiezi. Shannon, thanks for coming back on the show.
Always a pleasure, Ankit, although I wish Katie could be joining us as well.
That's right. Katie's not feeling great, but she will be back and ready to go, I'm sure, in a matter of days. But Shannon, I'm delighted to have you on in particular as we continue our focus here on the Asia Geopolitics podcast on the implications of the 2024 U.S. presidential election for Asia. And as I think listeners know, there is no better observer of the U.S.-China relationship and Chinese domestic politics at The Diplomat than you. And so I'm really hoping to use this episode to dig deep, given the information we have at the moment. Just so listeners know, we're recording this on November 25th, so we know a little bit about Trump's appointees, the shape of his cabinet, so on and so forth. And I think the place we'll begin today is by talking about the U.S.-China relationship under the second Trump administration. So Shannon, I think it goes without saying that I think across the board we are expecting a return to greater confrontation, certainly in the economic realm with the expectations of tariffs, broad-based tariffs focused on China, a second round of the trade war, but also potentially more confrontation in other realms as well. Let's kind of kick off maybe with where Trump is going to pick up the relationship, because I think that's important and it allows us to talk a little bit about some of the contemporary dynamics. So we just had a fairly interesting meeting between Presidents Biden and Xi on the sidelines of the APEC summit. Say a little bit about that meeting and kind of what the signposting there, particularly on the Chinese side, has been for the next U.S. administration. What is the message right now from China to the United States as this transition plays out?
Yeah, so this was a very interesting meeting because Biden is obviously on his way out. Pretty much everything said at that meeting, you can read it as kind of a swan song on Biden's side, really his chance to validate his administration's approach to China and emphasize why they think it was successful. From Xi Jinping's side, it's about setting expectations, particularly setting baselines for what they would like to see continuing with the U.S.-China relationship moving forward. And from that perspective, it was interesting that it was a fairly positive meeting. Both presidents really emphasized how the return to dialogue has stabilized the relationship. The words stable and healthy appeared quite frequently in both readouts. Because the Biden administration, of course, has had this insistence on we are competing with China, but we want to add what they call guardrails to keep the relationship from veering off course into outright conflict, while keeping plenty of policies that China finds objectionable, particularly export controls, stronger U.S. alliances in the Indo-Pacific. They're also making a point to talk to China and hold more frequent exchanges. And that, I think, is the piece that is unclear will continue under the Trump administration. Obviously, Trump originated the tariffs. He originated the export controls. And I think we can expect those sort of hard-nosed policies toward China to continue. But he generally doesn't look favorably upon diplomatic exchanges that were started under his predecessors. There's a lot of skepticism over whether Trump is going to be interested in engaging with China, and certainly whether some of his appointees are going to be interested in engaging with China the way that the Biden administration has been doing since they had a very testy first meeting in 2021. But really, since 2023, 2024, there have been a lot more mutually cooperative exchanges going on.
So, you know, let's talk a bit about the early contours of what is now starting to become clearer in terms of Trump's cabinet and some of his key national security advisor or advisory roles. So, you know, you have figures like Mike Waltz, Marco Rubio, the first Secretary of State to be under sanctions from the People's Republic of China. So you do have kind of traditional China hawks in a very kind of traditional Republican mold. At the same time, you have the economic warriors. You have Lighthizer, You have other figures in the administration that will be certainly willing to implement Trump's agenda on tariffs. How do you see this playing out, I guess, under the next administration? I know it's very difficult to predict the balance between Trump and his own advisors. I think the heuristic a lot of us have is that compared to the first term, this time it will be essentially Trump unleashed in many ways. I think he's prioritizing personal loyalty over kind of staffing his administration with the so-called adults in the room, I guess, the first time around. So what's your expectation for the early ways in which we're likely to see policy kind of towards China take shape?
Yeah, I think the difficulty with the Trump administration is that you get very different policies when Trump is hands-on and engaged and involved versus when he's letting his appointees take the reins. And with China policy kind of later in his first term, he seems to let especially Mike Pompeo, Trump's Secretary of State back in the latter half of his administration, take the wheel and, you know, really double down on certain things like, you know, labeling China's persecution of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang a genocide and things like that. So the question is whether Trump is going to let these hawkish China advisors like Waltz and Rubio have free reign to kind of set the contours of China policy, which I think would be something Beijing would not like to see. As you said, Rubio has been sanctioned by China for what they perceive as his unfriendly position on China issues. Or is Trump going to reach in and really direct things himself, in which case it's unpredictable which way this could go, because he's said a lot of really negative things about China, obviously, but he also sometimes praises Xi Jinping as a smart leader and a great man. He has this tendency to want to make massive deals that can be sold as wins for the American people. It's easy to forget that right as the COVID pandemic was exploding, Xi Jinping is signing a trade agreement with China that he essentially said would solve all of the economic issues in the relationship, which I think is something that Lighthizer would not be on board with, right? As he's said explicitly, he wants to fully decouple, full stop. So that is really the big unknown, right? Is how is involved is Trump personally going to be? The other unknown, is what is Elon Musk's role in all of this? He's kind of the outlier in that you have all of these hawkish figures, and then you have Elon Musk, who has, you know, Tesla plant in Shanghai. He's been very deferential to the Chinese government, you know, including telling people not to invest in Taiwan, recommending that Taiwan simply accept a status similar to Hong Kong and things like that. And he clearly has a role to play in the Trump administration. Now, he's not directly involved in foreign policy, but will he try to influence foreign policy anyway? We don't know. How influential is he actually with Trump? We don't know. And the third thing to keep in mind is that Trump's initial national security advisor, Michael Flynn, didn't even make it a month in office. His replacement, McMaster, and Trump's initial secretary of state, they were just in office about a year before they left. So the other question is, we're putting all this effort into analyzing the China policies of Mike Waltz, Marco Rubio. You know, will they even be there in 2026? That's something else we don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, hopefully nobody comes back to listen to this particular episode in 2025, because I'm sure a lot of what we'll be talking about will be overtaken very quickly as the unpredictability, as you put it, will play itself out. You know, Shannon, you alluded to massive deals, which is very much Donald Trump's kind of MO, or at least what he promises. And of course, in the U.S.-China context, that brings to mind the idea of grand bargains. And I think there's this interesting, I think, shared way of seeing the world that Trump and perhaps Xi Jinping have, which is that they're both essentially Bismarckians, I suppose, right, in the way that they do divide the world into the bigger countries that matter and then the smaller countries that matter less. And I think they both see the U.S. and China, respectively, as those bigger countries that can potentially take some decisions that could shape the fate of the Indo-Pacific and the broader world. And so in this kind of, you know, to kind of pull on that a little bit, this talk of a grand bargain that's been around in the context of U.S.-China relations for a while, I think the context in which that's starting to maybe return to the fore is, of course, in the context of Taiwan. You've already alluded to some of the, I guess, cognitive dissonance within the Trump administration, between the Rubios and the Musks and the Trumps, between all of these people on how the United States is going to navigate this with China going forward. So I'm inclined to think that we're not going to see a recompartmentalization of what used to be kind of the economic portfolio with China and then the strategic portfolio. Everything is connected. And so does that worry you when it comes to the potential for talk of a grand bargain, either over Taiwan or other core interests that the Chinese have in exchange for the U.S. potentially getting certain things on the economic file and other priorities?
Yeah, I know that that has been a concern in Taiwan because certain comments that Trump has made suggest that he sees Taiwan as ultimately indefensible. He's apparently not all that convinced the U.S. should be defending Taiwan unless Taiwan is willing to pay massive amounts of money for this quote-unquote insurance policy. But whether Trump is going to actually get to the level of saying, okay, I make a trade deal with China and, you know, putting this in air quotes, give them Taiwan, because of course that's not something a U.S. president can really do. I think the odds are very low because the phase one trade deal that Trump signed with China was pretty much a catastrophe.
Yeah.
And part of that, of course, was due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Essentially, under this agreement, China committed to buy, you know, billions of dollars worth of U.S. products, more than it had been buying, especially agricultural goods. It did not come anywhere close to meeting those targets. And now you can say, was China not sincere in the first place? Was it just that the pandemic tanked China's economy and it wasn't able to meet those commitments? I don't know from Trump's perspective that the reason really matters. It's basically he made this big deal with China that was supposed to solve U.S.-China trade and chip away at the trade deficit. And now, you know, the trade deficit's bigger than ever. He's takes things like that very personally. And certainly his advisors who are opposed to any sort of grand bargain with China are going to hammer on that and say, look, you already made a deal with China and they swindled you. And I think Trump does not want to be seen as the U.S. president who sold Taiwan out for a fake bill of goods. Right. There's that legacy issue of, you know, she doesn't want to be the Chinese president who lost Taiwan. I don't think Trump wants to be known as the U.S. president who sold Taiwan out for reasons that have everything to do with his own, you know, personal prestige and separate from Taiwan's well-being. But yeah, I'm also not sure what Xi Jinping would offer that would be attractive to the United States at this point, because again, on the economic front, it's kind of like we've been there, done that, right? China made all these big promises and they didn't live up to them. What is China actually going to offer the United States, and what could it offer? Because from China's perspective, Taiwan is our rightful territory. Does Xi Jinping really want to be seen making massive concessions to the United States for something that he says already belongs to China? I don't know that that would be necessarily good for Xi Jinping, right, and his rule over China.
But I mean, you know, in general, it strikes me that these kinds of debates, you know, I mean, Trump saying that he sees Taiwan as indefensible, treating U.S. defense guarantees, I mean, not just with Taiwan, but even with treaty allies, as insurance policies that countries have to pay for, I think it strikes me as dangerous from the perspective of increasing the risks of miscalculation, right? Because I think I agree with you that the unit of analysis that's often very relevant with Trump is, you know, ratings and ego and how he kind of sees certain events being perceived on the global stage and in the American media on Fox News. And so it's easy to imagine that these kinds of statements that he makes being overinterpreted either by the Taiwanese or the Chinese, and potentially leading to a place where conflicts or crises or even misunderstandings play out, and the U.S. actually turns out does want to ultimately defend Taiwan, and then you end up obviously in a pretty serious crisis. But, you know, taking a step back to this kind of guardrails issue, you know, the Trump administration is going to inherit, I think, a U.S.-China dynamic that I think is going to be unpredictable, is going to manifest in what have you, balloon incidents, unsafe aerial intercepts over the South China Sea, potentially naval encounters. And so the prospect for crises, I think, is there. And of course, you'll have a very different disposition in Washington towards managing those differences with China. So how much does that concern you in terms of the prospects for a serious crisis between the two countries spiraling it out? Or do you think there's enough of an institutionalized understanding now after the efforts we've maybe seen in the last 18 months to hopefully prevent the worst scenarios from spiraling?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the big concern in China-U.S. relations, right, is that you have a repeat of the EP3 Hainan incidents, mm-hmm. where, you know, there's fatalities from a collision between aircraft. You know, you could also see some sort of naval collision happening, given what's going on in the South China Sea. And one or both sides feel compelled to up the ante for, you know, reputational reasons. And then all of a sudden we have a China-U.S. war. It's a scary thought. I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility. I do think that China is conscious of the risks and the way that those risks have grown. It's kind of ironic because in the past, the U.S. has always really highly valued these military-to-military exchanges and has always seen China as the destabilizing actor who might, you know, do one of these unsafe aerial encounters and cause an accident and potentially, you know, spark a crisis or even a conflict. And now I think China is looking at the U.S. and thinking, oh, okay, we need to keep some of these conversations going. They're very important because we don't know how a Trump administration would react in this situation. And so now I think China is the one who's going to be a little bit more invested in keeping these dialogues going, which is not a dynamic that we have seen before. So it's kind of hard to know how it's going to play out.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's also interesting because, you know, one of the issues I think a lot about is arms control, right? I mean, that's going to be, I think, another priority that the Trump people are probably going to pick up. And they had a very rather unsubtle approach to that with China in the first administration with calls for trilateral arms control with the Russians and then putting Chinese flags on tables in Vienna and then criticizing Chinese diplomats for not showing up to a meeting that they had no intention of showing up to from the beginning. So maybe we will see some of that also play out. And, you know, that could lead to some bizarre outcomes. I mean, if there's anything with Trump, I mean, I think a few weeks before the U.S. election on a podcast, Trump, I think, alluded to the idea of the U.S., China and Russia giving up all of their nuclear weapons. And so I'm not saying he's going to do that. But again, I mean, the kinds of things that Trump might be willing to put on the agenda could be surprising to his own advisors, could be surprising to China. And I think the diplomacy with North Korea in the first term, I think, is, again, a good example of that when he sort of unilaterally cancels U.S. exercises with South Korea, so on and so forth. Shannon, I want to change gears briefly to address something I know you've been thinking about a little bit as well, changing gears from China, which is India, the other giant in Asia, the country that I think is probably the Asian country that views the U.S. election outcome in fairly favorable terms and thinks that there will be significant opportunities for India. There's been obviously an interesting piece of news recently, which is this fairly incredible indictment by the U.S. Department of Justice of Gautam Adani, the extremely wealthy Indian industrialist with close links to Narendra Modi. You've been looking at this a little bit. Tell our listeners a little bit about, first of all, what exactly is being alleged here and how you might see this affecting the U.S.-India relationship early in the next administration.
Sure. So just to give some background, Adani is, I think he's India's second richest person, but incredibly wealthy, incredibly influential businessman. And there's always been this perception that he is personally close to the Modi government, even Prime Minister Narendra Modi himself. There have been, you know, allegations that several overseas deals that the Adani group has done in Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, for instance, essentially the Modi government was leaning on its partners to sign these deals, with a private Indian company for Adani's personal benefit. So with that backdrop in mind, the U.S. Department of Justice indicts Adani and other members of the Adani group, alleging that they had paid over $250 million in bribes to unnamed Indian government officials to secure energy contracts. Of course, the Adani group has denied this, and even in the indictment itself, it says, you know, these people are innocent until proven guilty. You know, they haven't been convicted of anything yet, but the fact that such a prominent person was charged suggests that they feel pretty confident about being able to pursue these charges, because this is not a decision that would have been made lightly. Given the perception that Adani is close to Modi, given the fact that we don't know who in the Indian government he is alleged to have been paying these bribes to, there's a lot of potential for serious drama in Indian domestic politics stemming from this, because this is one of the major political weak points for Modi, is these kind of murky ties with the Indian business community, and whether or not his government is profiting from decisions that are being made. So far, it's been fairly restrained. The Indian government has never wanted to openly talk about any of these Adani allegations, and they continued that tradition by saying basically this is a matter for the company to deal with. But it's an interesting thorn in the India-US relationship at a time when, as you said, India has sky-high expectations. I think they had lots of reasons to prefer that Trump would win this election, a lot of them stemming from, you know, the Biden administration's more forward-leaning approach on human rights and putting pressure on India over its treatment of Muslims and other minorities. I don't think many people expect Trump to continue that, which is music to India's ears. And now, you know, kind of the waning days of the Biden administration, we have this bombshell indictment. And I think a lot is going to depend on how the two governments handle it. Of course, we don't know what will happen with this under the Trump administration when we have a new U.S. Attorney General, but the legal process tends to carry itself out. And it'd certainly be a major bombshell if the case was just dropped entirely for political reasons in the U.S.
Right. I mean, it reminds me in a way of some of the early conversations after the Meng Wanzhou indictment dropped in the first Trump administration, the Huawei CFO in the context of the U.S.-China relationship. And so this is, I think, going to be certainly something to watch early on as a bellwether. But I think, I mean, you know, the point you made about the Indian government not commenting on this, trying to separate as much as possible the state and Adani's enterprises, I think that I see is fairly unlikely to change. And so it's entirely possible that as this sort of plays out in the background, in Indian domestic politics, in the press, that the U.S.-India relationship will probably continue to move ahead under Trump, where I think India will very much be interested in essentially pursuing a reset a bit with Washington. There's also, of course, been the allegations of overseas and Indian intelligence agents being implicated in overseas intimidation and assassinations in the case of Canada of dissidents and what India perceives to be separatists. And so that too, I think, will be looming against the backdrop here.
Yeah, I think one interesting note, just to bring this back full circle, is India and China are having a bit of a thaw right now with their border patrol agreements. You know, you had, after years of hardly any high-level exchanges, you had Modi meet Xi, you had the Indian foreign minister meet the Chinese foreign minister and defense ministers met, you know, this sudden flurry of high-level engagements. So I think China could be sitting on the sidelines here saying, is this an opportunity for us? Can we sympathize with India about extraterritorial judicial overreach on the United States and meddling in your domestic politics, and maybe try and drive a wedge between a relationship that's of serious concern to China? So that's another dynamic to keep in mind as well.
That's right. Well, Shannon, I think I think we'll wrap it here for today. But as I told listeners on the last episode, I will reiterate that we will continue to watch the U.S. transition closely, given its many implications and reverberations across the Asia-Pacific region. My hope is on the next episode, we'll be able to talk a little bit about the reaction from Southeast Asia, which is actually where I was when the U.S. election results were announced earlier this month. But Shannon, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the show today and to share your insights, as always, about the U.S.-China relationship.
Sure, Ankit. I always have a good time on the podcast.
Fantastic. For listeners, make sure you subscribe so you can keep up with future episodes. And if you've been a subscriber for a while, don't forget to leave us a review. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts. We really do appreciate it. It helps us grow. And as always, if you have feedback for coverage of various topics on the show, do reach out to either myself or Katie, and we're very happy to take that into consideration as we plan future episodes of the Asia Geopolitics podcast. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.